Hello, welcome back to Millennial 2019. This is the fourth of four hangouts on, or not streams, I should say, on the fifth night, the last one tonight. Hangouts, that's a nice callback there to the platform that we all know and knew and loved for a long time, and which was so useful. But it's not there anymore, so we're using StreamYard. Now, my guest here is Dangerfield. So, is he hiding? Hello. I think you might be muted. Yes, you're muted.
Hi. You know what? I nearly sprinted over then to close my bathroom door, and I am naked as the day I was born, and that would have been absolute gold for you lot, not me. So, wow, that was close.
Of all the reasons to get my channel banned, that would be so ridiculous. The most unexpected reason. Well, anyway, welcome back to Millennial.
It's an absolute pleasure. I was just saying to Woz before the stream, it's a pleasure to have made the grade second year. I feel like I'm part of it now.
Yes, of course. Well, I mean, the one that we did last year was so enjoyable, and I think a lot of people really liked it. So it seemed inevitable, an obvious choice to have you back. Of course, I'm also having, I've had the Iconoclast, and On the Offensive will be coming back. So it's the three of you. I mean, I did consider doing one with the three of you together as the Three Stooges, but I thought it's more fun because each of you is so different that it's worth having you on separately. So there we are.
It's such a peculiar little stream, that Three Stooges. I mean, the dynamic is bizarre. We're like three brothers. We've got that kind of older brother, middle brother, younger brother thing. Hugh's there, the younger brother. He wants all the attention. He wants all, you know, he's always shouting. He's always drinking as well, which is his choice. And then Dan's the older brother, just sort of sitting back, you know, looking at the folly of youth. And I'm sort of stuck in between, not sure of my place at all. But it works. People like it. It's good fun.
Excellent. Is that on, actually, where is that located nowadays?
We still do it on YouTube, but what I do now is we stream it live on YouTube, and then if it gets a bit close to the edge, which, I mean, the edge is moving towards us these days, I'll tend to delete it so it's still live to watch afterwards on YouTube.
On BitChute. So there is that gradual migration to BitChute that everyone is undertaking in various ways. I mean, I've deleted during the various purges this year, I think I ended up deleting about, well, more than 300 videos of mine. So they're, I mean, it's ridiculous, but what can you do? So they're gradually appearing on, or reappearing on my BitChute channel now. So if anyone's unable to find an old video of mine that they particularly enjoyed, subscribe to my BitChute. It will show up there eventually, almost certainly. So anyway, so yes.
It's
You take it.
You're jumping in and out, so I'm not sure where you are. It's
all right. I'm here.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing, BitChute. I've had the pleasure of to Ray Vahi. It's his thing, and you know, it's run by him and his mate. I mean, you know, there's two blokes running a platform which is currently providing an almost legitimate competitor to one of the biggest companies on the planet. There's two of them. They've got no funding. And, you know this more than most. It's a nightmare every day you wake up. Have I lost my YouTube channel today? I'll just check. Because at some point we're going to, you know, they don't want us there. We're unwanted. We're, you know, and what Ray's doing over there is incredible. He said they're looking at doing some kind of fundraising and then rolling out live streaming. If they get that sorted, I think it's going to be an even better platform. And I'm so grateful for it, because if I was to lose my YouTube channel, I've done all that other stuff. What was it when everyone signed up to that other platform and it just went? What one was that? Vimeo?
Vidme.
That's it, yeah. I even went to a friend in London's house who had a faster internet connection. I spent a whole weekend uploading everything and it just went. On the Monday, it disappeared. I'm very, very grateful to BitChute.
You said that BitChute are working on live streaming. Not only that, I don't know if I've said this. I think I have said this before. But they're also working on a Hangouts replacement, which will work exactly the same as the old Google Hangouts did. And it will, so it'll be fantastic. I'm really excited about the future of BitChute. I think it's got a future, basically. I think it's going to be the place. So, once YouTube just culls us all, I think the whole thing will sort of spontaneously be reborn on BitChute.
And it has a feel of early YouTube. I mean, excuse me. It's 10 a.m. here in sunny Cambodia. So you've got your towel around you there, your blanket woes. It's a cool 32 degrees here at the moment. But I went to bed at 5 a.m., so I've only had a few hours sleep, so I'm a little bit hazy. But so hazy, I forgot what I was going to say.
I was talking about the Hangouts thing that they're going to implement.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to BitChute, it reminds me of early YouTube. And you can be shocked. You can start watching a video and you're just like, oh, shit. And, people can upload pretty much what they want. And it has that kind of excitement. You don't know where a video is going. The one that really made it clear for me was Mechator, Mr. Mechator. He's pretty much scrapped everything on YouTube. He's still getting letters from them saying that they've had a panel of specialists look at his content and it's been decided. And he's like, there's nothing on there. What are your specialists looking at? But I watched his How Sausages Are Made. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen this, no.
He's done a video called How Sausages Are Made. And a friend of mine said, oh, go and check out Mechator's new video. So I've gone over How Sausages Are Made, and it's a video about the reality of transgender surgery processes. And my days, it's a very different story. It's not rainbow flags and glitter, I can assure you. I really recommend it. But I watched that, and to hear the way he was talking, to see what was on the screen, it was amazing to suddenly see how different expression, cultural and creative expression can be when you're not thinking about every single word might get you banned. And it was his complete character was different. And it was only then, once I had to measure things by, once I had something to judge things by, you realize how suffocating, how curtailed we are on YouTube. And I think that's really interesting because younger people coming up, they're going to watch things, they watch the mainstream, which is what YouTube's trying to be with all this censorship. And that's how they then understand and consider the world. And yet, if you go somewhere where you're not censored like that, it's a different world. Literally a different world.
It's not just that you... Or you can use rude words or something, or you can say specifically, you can make specific controversial points. It's that your entire attitude is more relaxed. I mean, I feel very much like I've got a gun against my head on YouTube now. And I know folk will say, well, why are you still on it? Of course I'm still on it because of the reach. But, it's... The reality, it's just a practical reality. I want to stay on YouTube as long as I can. But at the same time, the experience of being a YouTuber is nowhere near what it used to be. It used to be fun. Whereas nowadays, it's just not fun. It's just not enjoyable anymore. And I feel like we're constantly censoring ourselves at a level that is very subtle. We're careful about the wording and all that. But even more, there are things that I wouldn't even go into. There are things, it's subjects, whole areas that I just wouldn't even venture into now. It's gone from broadcast yourself to nothing, really.
Broadcast yourself to nothing. Listen, I'm going to switch internet connection, so I might out for a split second.
Oh, all right. I think that was him switching out for a second. Let's hope it's momentary. I mean, I don't want to overstate things. I mean, here he is.
All good. Sorry. That what you said there is exactly what I mean. It's not just the odd word or the subject you can't go near, just your general approach to your creativity. It has a huge, largely unconscious impact on your persona and your content.
Yeah.
And I should really ask Ray, really, but is BitChute, because it uses BitTorrent technology, that's why I say that as if I know what it is, but is that why there's not a free speech issue, as it were, because he's not actually hosting content?
That's one part of it. The legality, as I understand it, that's one way to avoid legal culpability, because they're not storing it. I mean, it's just a very decentralized, or it's going to be very decentralized as a service. It's going to be very much a web 3.0 or web 4.0 service in the end. It's not going to be a one website where all of the stuff is stored and all of the tools are. It's going to be very something else.
Yeah, it's really encouraging. I do advise, but I encourage people to go over there, subscribe to people you like, and use it, because really, without these alternatives and without them getting support, not just from content creators but viewers, you know, that they can't survive without people using them. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm not in great regular contact with them, but I've just had a few conversations where we talked about, this kind of thing. So I don't know it intimately, but I do know that he's aiming for it to be very, very pro-free speech. Because he's not, the thing, he's not even, and it's important to state that since we're talking about BitChute, it's important to state he is not a terribly controversial guy in his own views. He's just very pro-free speech. That's it. Mm-hmm. And of course, the media are always doing these hit pieces on BitChute and trying to characterize him as some kind of, you know, insane, crazed right-wing maniac. But actually, he's more than anything else, he's actually centrist or ex-leftist. He just is a guy who really wants people to have their say. So, it's quite the opposite of what the way it's portrayed by the mainstream media. Of course, it's interesting. Why is it that the mainstream media does this? I mean, remember when there have been several funding platforms that were just attacked. See, this is what they do. They say, well, just build your own Twitter. Just build your own YouTube. Yeah. And when you do it, they fucking tried everything to get it shut down. I mean, the insincerity is just fucking revolting.
Yeah, it's awful. Speaking of media making attacks, I managed to wangle another 30 days free on Netflix. I mean, it's a real hamster's wheel of passwords and IPs. But I've managed to do it again. And last night I was watching Peaky Blinders. I mean, interesting anyway, from a cultural perspective, this show that it kind of taps into so many sort of base common denominators. You'll sit through 7 or 8 episodes and not really know why. You know, it's just what's left after anything that might offend or repulse has been taken out. You know, we really live in a remains culture. And suddenly they got onto Oswald Mosley made an appearance. And it's just incredible. He's slamming the table and he's a misogynist and he's an arsehole. And and I was just like, you know, this is amazing. And then just while I was dealing with that, there's now it's all race. Now the lead protagonist has gone to this nunnery. This is where I was watching just before we come on. He's gone to this nunnery to wreak revenge on the head nun who abused a mixed race girl, made her wash with different soap. Now, there's a story there, but it's like, what? Hang on. What? And it feels to me like the writers of Peaky Blinders got to like season 6 and become woke and thought, we've got to get it all in.
You know, it's fucking ridiculous when the modern TV writers use some historical setting to make a point that a modern progressive would make today, but no one would have made. I saw an episode of I just watched the start of it for obvious reasons. I switched off the start of an episode of Endeavor, which is this prequel to Morse, and it's set, I believe, in the early 60s or mid 60s when he's at Oxford. And it's just so naff. And even the name, I mean, who the fuck is called Endeavor? Come on. Anyway, it's tacky, gimmicky. But anyway, so he's at this lecture theatre and it's a discussion on race and whatever. And there's this black guy there speaking, a black Englishman, and he makes the point that, well, the latest science says that the first British people were black. So when people tell me to go home, I say, after you.
Oh!
Oh!
Yeah.
And so, the audience are in rapturous applause. They just they're in awe of his cleverness and hilarity. And then you see a close up of Inspector Morse, yet to become Inspector Morse. And he's one of them going, I mean, what a bunch of just wank. And also, it's just no one, I'm certain that nobody was making that argument in the early 60s. Because the whole thing wasn't, that whole thing was, did not exist. That argument did not exist then. So,
and even if one outlier was making it, that's not the response you're going to get.
No.
That is not the response you're going to get. I'm a real fan of Matt Berry. I don't know if you know Matt Berry, the comedian.
Yeah,
he's
funny, yeah.
Very
yeah.
funny man. Loads of very interesting little linguistic sort of flourishes that I really, really like him. I don't like a lot of sort of media comedy, so it's nice to find something you like. And he's done this new thing called Year of the Rabbit, and it's quite interesting. I saw him in an interview, and he said it's like the Sweeney, but set in like 1850. And it really is. He sort of comes on, he goes, oi, get your fucking ass round. You know, he's like the Sweeney, but in like all this old sort of Victorian Edwardian. One of the two, steady. But in the opening credits, there was more black people than white people. This is Victorian England. More black people than white people in the opening. I'm making a video about it at the moment. And there's even a mixed race couple, black man, white woman, of course, walking down the steps. And you'd expect people in our position are used to this sort of thing, but I just had to rewind it. That must have been a dream. It was bizarre. You know, I'm on the internet. Black population of England, 1850.
Yeah, that is absolutely ridiculous. I remember seeing an episode of Doctor Who from about 2013 or 14. Maybe 15, and it was unbelievable. I mean, most of the actors were non-white, and you'd think, and it was actually set in, I think, in Britain in the present day, and also on an alien planet, Skaro, the Dalek planet, and it's unbelievable. I mean, you would think that Britain today, from where they're sourcing, the population from which they're sourcing the actors, was majority non-white. So, but that's ridiculous enough. But then to project it backwards to 1850 is another level of stupidity. I mean, it's just incredible how they're, it's an obvious point to make, it's been made many times, it's incredible how they are misrepresenting all of this.
Well, I think they know where the future's going, and they're pandering to the larger marketplace. You know, they're not looking at pandering to young white people. They're looking at pandering to young black people because they have got their ideas of demographic changes.
When you say black, do you mean just general non-whites, like people of colour?
Well, yeah, people of colour, of course. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the angle. I done a stream the other night and I was talking. My day job is e-commerce, and there was one day when I used about 12 different financial platforms, you know, banks, foreign currency exchanges, whatever. And I made a point, because of the relentless onslaught, out of the 12 platforms I used, I think 8 of them were people of color. And I am now just guessing, but about 3 or 4 of them were mixed race couples, always white woman, male of color. And I just thought, you know, and they weren't global. These are British companies. Most of them were. And I get it, but it's so nauseating.
It's just endless. It's endless propaganda. I mean, the producer of Doctor Who famously said that he wanted to, he didn't care that it was unrealistic. They were inventing a fiction because it would be better than reality.
Can I ask you, Because I argued with Hugh about this, and that was my point. I said, look, if you're in a corporation and you've got your marketing team in and you're putting out your landing page for your foreign exchange business or whatever, PayPal, whatever, HSBC, you know, when the marketing team says we need a mixed race couple here, are they selling that on their bottom line, or are they selling that on a kind of doing the right thing, re-diversity? Do you see what I'm asking? Because Hugh stood by. I don't want to misrepresent Hugh here. So that was just, you know, the point remains. There's two sides of this debate. Is it that the marketing team is saying, you know, it's important that we, you know, are diverse in our advertising, or is it a bottom line thing? Are they saying, look, in the next 10 years, the people of colour market is going to be bigger than the white market, so we should be representing them?
But it won't be in the next 10 years. I mean, in the next 30 years, it might be. But by that time, all these old adverts and products will be long forgotten. So I don't believe that it's for the bottom line thing. I think it's ideology. I just think it's ideal. In fact, I think it will even harm their bottom line. I think that... go on.
But how do you get that past... How do you get that past the you know, the directors? If you commission a marketing team and they come in and, you know, most marketing departments are external to corporations, so they come in and they say, okay, let's see our new video. And then they sit back and go, well, it seems to me that there's not very many white people in that advert. And then the marketing companies say, yeah, but diversity.
Yeah.
And they're probably like, yeah, but 90% of our customers are white.
Yeah, but who's going to say that, though? Because to even say that is to open yourself up to the accusation that you're racist.
Yeah, but if you're a multi-billion dollar owner of the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, I reckon you'll have the balls to say, no, bollocks.
Well, maybe, but what if you can get reported and lose your job? And then you've got to explain to your next prospective employer why you lost your job. That's because I said something, I said something racist.
You know what? I've never considered people at that level being under this thumb, but I guess you're suggesting they are. I would have thought that directors of international banks could just say, no, fuck off. We want more of our actual customers.
I'd hope that they could. I mean, I'd hope that they're not that ideological and all that, but I suspect that they are. I mean... Who the fuck in the corporate world today, who would want to sully themselves, to saddle themselves with the reputation of being a racist? I think it would be career suicide.
But then surely, I think it would be career suicide for the marketing department, because if they came in and then it was obviously a woke social justice advert and the boss then thought, well, I can't say anything because I'll be stained with racism, but next time we won't be hiring these clowns.
Well, I think an interesting way to test this would be to monitor the career of the woman who directed that Gillette advert. Remember at the start of this year, there was the fucking awful Gillette advert. She was a woman. I think she was Polish or something. Let's watch what happens to her career, because she tanked the profits of Gillette with that advert. It really did damage to them. I think she's still going to be in gainful employment now and in for the foreseeable future, because no one gives a fuck about the profits.
Yeah, they lost about 8 billion, didn't they?
Did they? Was it that much?
Yeah. And also they were running, you know, there was this whole story about that, you know, Gillette, they're abandoning 33 decades of men of man and all that. But there was that best a man can get masculine men adverts were running concurrently with that woke advert. That, you know, there's this myth to the sort of general public that adverts run in series, but they don't. They run many different adverts to yeah, an interesting story from, have you ever read, you're an art college boy, it's kind of standard reading, The Hidden Persuaders by Vance Packard.
I'm afraid I haven't.
It's a great book.
Ignorant and unequipped.
If you watch enough of my streams, that's always the book I quote. Oh, have you read Vance Packard's Hidden Persuaders? It's my one quotable book. But it's an amazing book about the early days of mass marketing and focus groups and all that sort of stuff. And there's a whole chapter in it about this company who, I can't remember who the company is, but they run three different adverts for the same product to appeal to women at different parts of their menstrual cycle. And it, you know, and the results come in and it's just incredible. Mm.
Fucking hell.
I never
thought of that.
It's a mind-blowing book. Let me give you a couple of little stories from it. For people watching, it's called The Hidden Persuaders, and the author is Vance Packard. There's this bloke, I think his name's Dr. Dichter or Richter. I can't remember his name, but he was one of these early geniuses in mass marketing. And it changed everything, you know, as you know. If you look at advertising pre sort of 1955, it was kind of sort of guesswork, nonsense, really. And this bloke come along. He was the first person to use focus groups. He was the first. He coined the term focus group. The first person to use depth probing, which was taking on board the sort of psychoanalytic growth in the middle of the 20th century. And he approached Colgate. He'd done all his research before he'd approached the company. He approached Colgate and he said, "I'll sell approximately 15% more toothpaste for you." And they went, yeah, let's do it. And he'd done all his research and he found out that people, when they put toothpaste on their brush, they don't judge an amount of toothpaste based on the quantity of toothpaste. They do it based on the length of toothpaste on their brush. So some people might do a third of their brush, you know, long of toothpaste. Some people 50% of their brush, some people the length of their brush. So what he did was got Colgate to open the tube end by an increase of 15%, because in that way you will sell 15% more toothpaste because people go by the length on their brush, not the amount of toothpaste. It's an incredible book, man. It's full of little gems like that.
Fucking hell. Was this Edward Bernays?
I think he gets a mention in it, but I don't know a lot about Bernays. I've heard the name, but no, it's this Dr. Richter Dichter or something. It's a peculiar name. It's the stuff of nightmares. another really cool one he did was this jelly company. In America, it's called Jell-O, isn't it? You know, jelly. It's cow hooves and orange flavoring. You put boiling water in it. It sets into this sort of gelatin, you know, jelly. And they'd put millions into this new marketing campaign. They had all their boxes redesigned. And on the little box of jelly, they had this sort of like three-tier jelly with cream, little cream spots on it, hundreds and thousands. The next level was custard and then jelly. And on top, some glassy cherries, you know, loads of money, full color printing, which was still quite a big deal in like the late 1950s. And sales went down. They spent millions on this marketing and sales actually went down. So old Richter Dichter, that's not his name, but I like saying it. He turned up and he said, look, I'll sort this out for you because I'm a genius at this stuff. I'm the new man in town. And he done his focus groups, done his depth probing, got loads of new mothers in, done all the research. And basically he found out that what happens when that little kid is walking along the supermarket aisle with the new mother. She's got one in a pram. She's got a little toddler. They see that pack of jelly with this ornate, elaborate three-tier dessert. And they're like, mom, I want this. Mother looks at that and she's thinking, you're fucking joking. I ain't got time to make that. I can't reproduce that. And if I get home and I pour some boiling water into a jug and make an inch thick sort of gelatin slab, and it doesn't look anything like the cover, I'm going to feel less than. You're going to be disappointed. No, it goes back on the shelf. So old Richter Dichter said, look, get rid of this little plastic bowl with jelly in it and lose all the color. We can do this in two tones. Just keep it basic. On the cover is what the mother's going to make. And sales went through the roof. Absolutely flew. Yeah.
So that's something that's manageable. They can identify it with themselves. I could do that.
Yeah, yeah. And also not be threatened by the what's expected of you.
Right. It is interesting how much of this is about, I think that big switch that occurred in advertising in the 50s was basically to stop talking about the product and instead talk about or communicate about how the product will change your life. And basically that it's a wonderful thing which you want to be associated with.
Yeah, well, the big thing that, you know, the big thing over the last sort of 20 years, which has gone into sort of almost hyper real proportions in the last sort of 15 because of e-commerce and the incredible growth in people buying on their phones. You know, you can make a purchase on your phone as you're walking to the bus stop. The big thing is solving a problem in your life. How does, if you want to sell a product on a website, you've got to establish how does this solve a problem in the customer's life? And then the next stage of that is, how do you convince the customer that they've got the bloody problem? So, you know, it's like a new level. You go to a website. Oh, I went around a friend's house the other day and it smelled lovely. It smelled lovely. You know, some kind of electronic incense. I need to get one of these things for my room. So that's all you want to do. But you go to a website that sells those electronic incense. Before long, suddenly you've got a stinky house. They'll tell you that, you know, they'll give you problems that you didn't know you had. And that's the new thing in e-commerce, selling the customer, selling the potential customer problems they haven't even got. And then once you've embedded that into them and you've tapped into fears, insecurities, your house stinks. Yeah, people come around. Did you know that you can't smell your own house? I mean, you must remember when you were a kid, you go around your friends' houses and they smell of biscuits and milk and sweat. And you think, oh, Johnny Davis's house stinks. Oh, so everyone else's house smells. But when you get back to yours, nothing, because you're used to it. It's just your smell. So they'll remind you of that. Oh, your friends won't tell you your house stinks. And the less they tell you, probably the more it stinks. You know, these are the kind of amazing sort of psychological backflips they'll do in your head. And you only wanted to buy some incense. Now you're suddenly tackling a terrible truth. And of course, then once they've embedded this new problem, you want to solve it. And lo and behold, scroll down a couple, the answer to what is now the problems of your life. It's really, you know, if you look at Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Bezos wanted, one of the things he wanted to do was to create a public holiday, and he's done it. And it's the biggest spend of the year. I mean, I don't know the numbers offhand, but look at it. It's just every year it's going up about 50% in spend. This new public holiday of absolute, you know, commodification is just insane.
And surely that is all there can possibly be to that holiday. It's just we buy things on this day.
Yeah, let's spend money. There's going to be sales. Yeah. I mean, I work in that industry. And, you know, I don't know. Let me tell you this. This is kind of interesting. When I work in e-commerce. I set a company up years ago and I still work there. I'm not the sole owner anymore, but. Yeah, took me eye off the ball. But years ago, marketing emails, you'd have a mailing list. You know, when you go to a website, join our newsletter, every website, join our newsletter, and you funnel people to that so that you've got a mailing list. And then now and again, you send them an email. Hey, look at our new products. Hey, look at this. Well, the way that has changed over just the last 10 or 15 years is mind-blowing. The big thing at the moment, there's two things. There's workflows and segmentation. And segmentation is just next level. What happens now is you segment your mailing list into different segments based on their behaviors. Now, their behaviors can be obvious things like what have they previously bought? So if they've previously bought product A, B, and C, you can upsell D, E, and F because they're things that go with A, B, and C. That's kind of obvious. Nothing too sort of dodgy about that. But you can also segment people based on where their cursor has gone on the screen. Yeah. When you go to a website and, you know, you tend to put your arrow where you're reading. People do. But, yeah, and you can get heat maps of where – you can say, right, there's bits of software. You can say, right, Tuesday, the 3rd of December, show me the heat map for the whole day of where the majority of cursor arrows went. And if you've got like a particular hotspot here, get a sale in there, pop a sale, you know, and you can base all these segments on things like that, customer behavior, how long they spend on the website, many, many different things. Have they bought a product in the last 30 days? They haven't opened an email in 3 months, blah, blah, blah. That's one segment. So when you send your mailing, your marketing email, you might be offering 10% off to all the people who've bought a product in the last month. But if they haven't bought a product in the last 6 months and haven't opened an email in 6 months, you offer them 40% off because then they might open the email. And so instead of sending one email now, you're sending 10, 15, 20 to one mailing list, all based on segments, based on their your potential customer's behavior.
See, I find that people are saying my mouth has been open for a few minutes and my mind is blown. I do find this stuff fascinating, and I always have done. I love hearing about how something is analyzed and simplified and a solution is found for it. And yes, it's sinister because it's manipulation, but it's also fascinating because you're seeing that these people have found a way to persuade and to solve a problem for themselves, which is to sell more money, to pay more money, sell more products. And I can't help but admire that and find it very interesting. And
it just ends up itself, you
know, the ingenuity. It's really interesting.
No, it's incredibly fascinating. You know, anywhere that involves the chance of making money, that's where you'll find the best brains, you know, because let me tell you this. When you get an email in your inbox, so, you know, we've all still got, and we haven't unsubscribed for some weird reason. Like I'm subscribed to a couple of vape newsletters, and I'll get a thing, it'll say 15% off, and then there'll be a couple of words, and that's it. That hasn't just come to you. That's come to me based on what emails I've opened, what I've purchased before, how long I've spent on their website. I have, due to the way I behave on their website, it's put me in a particular segment. But listen to this. That subject line, you know, just a few words. The ideal subject line is 26 characters. That seems to work the best. Now, there are people that get paid in excess of $1 million for writing one subject line. Yeah, 26 characters. And when I tell people that, like, they're like, nah, that just seems ridiculous. But you've got to see it in terms of value to the customer. By customer, I mean the people running the marketing, not the back end front end purchaser. So say it's a company like Apple, and say they're bringing out a new iPhone or whatever. If you can get 10% more people to open that email worth an additional $20 million because of the size of the audience, because of the value of the product. So if you can write email subjects that can get 10% more people to open it, that's worth millions to that company. So you can charge £1 million. There are people who do it for a living. They just write subject lines and they are absolute geniuses.
Well, of course. I mean, if that's what it's worth to the company, then yeah, it sounds astonishing to us. But well, maybe not to you, but I'm not sure. But to me, it certainly does. But of course,
no, for sure,
there it is. It's obviously they're thinking of what are we going to get out of this? So yeah, it's worth it.
I mean, what a cush job, though. You know, you do your research. They do their depth probing. They probably get focus groups. They'll send out testers. They'll have mailing list tests and all that. They'll have entire mailing lists that are just testers that they've bought from other companies. They'll spend 4 or 5 weeks perfectly sculpting that to get as many opens as possible. You know, sometimes I do a marketing email, and it'll be something as simple as, we have your order. That one works a treat. We have your order. And that can go out to 20,000 people who haven't made an order in 6 months. And that will get 60% opening, which the industry standard is about 20%. And people are like, oh, you've got what? Hang on, I didn't make an order. What? Bosh. And as soon as you've opened it, then I've got a full page, beautiful photo.
It'd be funny if what they found was a photo of you looking smug saying, bosh. I got you. Dangerfield wins.
Yeah. Imagine, yeah. No order. Yeah, it's you know, sometimes when I'm involved in all that stuff and doing it, I feel like the bloke in network, you know, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah. So I thought you meant network. I know it. Yeah. It's a great film, actually.
Yeah, really is. But I really recommend that book. I'll tell you what, after the stream, I'll talk to you. I'll get your postal address. I'll buy you that book for your Christmas. You'll love it if you love this sort of stuff. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
And it's the 50s.
That's amazing. But I guess, has much actually changed since the 50s?
Well, you've got technology now, haven't you? So you can certainly process stuff a lot quicker. You know, you've got the ability, you know, in terms of the actual marketing, well, yes and no. I mean, I don't know a lot of the contemporary sort of, I don't know a Hidden Persuaders of now. So maybe there's probably a load of stuff I don't know about. But the kind of basics is certainly remained the same. I mean, because what you've got in 1950s America, there's a few different things that happened. You've got Freud kind of got popular about 1905 when he published The Interpretation of Dreams. That was kind of his big, you know, it was almost like a bestseller, you know, and that's weird because it's psychology. It's heavy going psychology. It's not a book of, oh, hang on, I dreamt my teeth fell out, page 112. Oh, it means you love your father too much. It's not like that. It's case studies and stuff. But you've got the sort of psychoanalytic revolution. And then I think, 1920 or something, you got people coming back from the First World War with shell shock. And that's when sort of they started understanding that people have got mental problems due to what were previously considered physical disorders. And they, along with the explosion of psychoanalysis, there's now an understanding of psychosis and traumas. Then you've got Ferdinand de Saussure's General Course in Linguistics, where he outlines semiotics. And so all of that sort of stuff comes together. Then you get television, sort of 1950s. So now you've got psychoanalysis, semiotics, and mass media. And when you put those three things together, you kind of get the explosion in advertising and marketing.
Right.
And I think we're still, I think, you know, when they let off a nuclear bomb and you get that big mushroom cloud, I think that is still expanding now. It's part of the same explosion. I don't think much has changed at the heart of the nuclear fission of 1950s America is still at the center, but we're now an expanding cloud of doom. But the worrying thing about it, you know, interesting what you say, that on the one hand it's fascinating, but it is manipulative. There is another side to it which is of concern to me, in that when you're making decisions based on the past behavior of customers and you're making decisions about the future, you're then almost, it could be said that you're almost creating the future. And when marketeers and advertisers are creating the future, is that a sign of a healthy society, or is it the sign of a very, very sick place? Well,
didn't Steve Jobs or somebody of his ilk say that you don't find out what the market wants? You tell the market you tell the customer what they want. And so they, like the iPad, well, for example, with people didn't really have tablets in those days. They were a crappy thing that Microsoft had attempted, but not really managed. And the iPad and the iPhone and the iPod, actually. I mean, the MP3 player was a fairly niche thing until the iPod made it a fashion accessory.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, when you go online, every single marketing and advertising is based on what you've done before. So when you go on Facebook, all those adverts, you must have seen it when you've been followed around the internet by an advert. You went online and thought, oh, I want to buy a new laptop. Let's have a look at this. Oh, that looks nice. Dell Inspiron. Oh, yeah, I don't know. And then you go to a completely different site. Oh, I want to go and check the football results. And there's an advert for that same computer that you looked at yesterday. And that will keep happening. And then your experience of the internet, which we've allotted such grandiose ideas to, like it's the new public space, it's the new public square. Well, it's also been completely infested by advertising. You know, public space, actual non-digital public space, has almost completely disappeared due to advertising. But your digital experience is dominated by advertising. And the future of your digital experience is based on what you've done in the past. Not to make it better for you, not to make it more informative, not to make it more, not to give you greater connections with people, but to sell you stuff. And if the internet is the new public space, well, the new public space is a market.
Yeah.
Which it didn't used to be. You know, yeah. The Greek city-state was very clear in dividing itself. It had the polis, which is where politics were discussed. It had, I can't remember what it was called, but the domestic space, and it had the marketplace. And they were intentionally distinct for reasons. And when you start mixing them up, so the political and the market and the domestic is kind of the same space, they infiltrate and affect each other in ways that where they all suffer. And the real suffering is, of course, the lowly human that wanders among it, wondering what the fuck's going on.
What would you say happens when the polis and the commercial space are merged? I mean, people would say that that's the situation now, the world that we have, where, you know, corporate interests control government.
Well, yeah, of course. Of course. And then on top of that, you know, political campaign advertising is almost like the pure expression of the confusion of those spaces. I mean, what is going on there? I mean, you know, do you remember that Blair's market, those were like pop videos, 3 or 4 minutes long. And I can remember that, and it was part of the strategy. Without doubt, it's part of the strategy. We were building up to it, news shows. And we've just heard that 3 o'clock on Saturday will be the debut, the premiere, no less. What's going on? The premiere of the new Labour advert. It's 3 o'clock Friday. Are we going to see a little trailer now? Spoiler alert, there's a couple of seconds of the Blair advert. This all happened. And you had the same with Michael Jackson's Thriller. You know, it was like there was a countdown to the Thriller promo. And I use that word deliberately because they're adverts to sell records. They're not anymore.
The thing is, all of this, on the one hand, yeah, it's bad because it's manipulation of people. But on the other hand, it's fun. You know, like music videos. Some of them are awful. Nowadays, they're all awful. But there are really cool ones. Like, for example, the video for Michael Jackson's Black or White. I remember that coming out. I remember it in 1991. And it was a massive fucking thing. I mean, people were actually talking about how much it cost to make. I think it was like £30,000 per second that people were saying. I don't know if that's even true. But I remember people saying it was like this huge, nothing like this has ever happened before. I'm sure it was the same in 9 years earlier with Thriller. And another thing that folk do now is Doctor Who. I'm sorry to keep bringing Doctor Who into the millennial chats. I'm not an obsessive fan. I do like the original series, but not the new stuff. But I'm just bringing it in here as an academic thing. Kind of. Something
you really insecurely tightened your blanket when you made your final defense then.
I'm sorry, everyone. But it does interest me that one thing they do now is they film an extra scene and they make it into a wee prequel thing for an episode. And I think that's a really cool thing because then, I mean, it's fun. You know, it's enjoyable.
Well, it's no mistake that it's fun and enjoyable. It needs to be. It needs to engage you. But let's just, I mean, I don't think this is necessarily good or bad. We just need to understand how it functions, why it functions, and what the implications are for our society. It, you know, pop videos are promos, they're adverts. And in the Doctor Who thing's a little bit more difficult because there's not really a commodity as such. I mean, you pay your license fee, it's kind of more of a teaser. But in the example, I used to work in pop videos, and it's a very bizarre world. I mean, now it's kind of almost disappeared in England. But, you know,
that's how a lot of directors got started. I mean, like Alien 3 was directed by David Fincher, and prior to that, he'd done loads of music videos. I think the guy who did The Crow, Alex Proyas, he was the same. But just before you get to music videos, let me just briefly say, I've got a sort of admission, a confession to make, which is talking about these teaser things. Every year, I think, wouldn't it be fun to do some kind of advertising thing for Millennial? And I did have quite a few. Like last year, I did these things on Instagram. I just lost Twitter at that point. So, in fact, the year before, when I still had Twitter, I did memes, and it would be how did I do this now? I did the hover handing thing where it was me with two female guests that were going to be on Millennial, and I was hover handing them, and it was a meme, it was a thing, and it was funny. I certainly laughed as I photoshopped those. And then last year I did where it was it would always be like a couple who were having, you get these stock photos of a couple having marital problems or sexual problems, and the guy is sitting on the bed looking forlorn, and the woman's looking concerned. How can I get through to my husband and all that? And the speech bubbles would be something about Millennial. Like one of them wanted to watch it and the other one didn't. And this stuff was all just hilarious to me. I thought it was funny. And that was on Instagram last year. It was just a laugh, you know. This year I had an idea, but I didn't actually do it. Whereas I was going to do, it was going to take a bit of organization, and in the end I just couldn't do it. You know that one from the Gillette ad where the guy, it was a famous meme where the guy is looking at some woman walking past, and he makes some lascivious sound towards her, and then a black guy intervenes to, you know. And I was thinking it'd be hilarious. Is it to film me just standing there outside a shop, and then this woman walks past, marked Millennial, and she's walking past, and then I see her and go, hey! And, you know, start to see her, and then Sargon comes out of the shop and intervenes. And said, no, not cool. And that the idea being that he's ruined Millennial, which I thought it'd be funny, you know? I thought it'd be hilarious, especially if he was blacked up, like to be like the guy in the Gillette advert.
But I'm sure after his Patreon issues, being blacked up on one of your adverts is going to go down great. It'll probably be erased from the internet. But, you know, this is my point. It's not good or bad to do with the possible impact it has for society, and that's just an advert. You should have gone to someone on Fiverr and given your idea, and for $20 someone would have knocked it up.
Yeah, it would be a pretty girl and Sargon and a shop and somebody to film from some distance. And that's really all it would have taken. I mean, I could have done it if I could have, you know, rendezvoused with Sargon somewhere. I think it would be
next hilarious. Year.
Well, next year we've forgotten the meme though by then, so it won't be fresh.
Yeah, we'll do a different one.
Yeah.
No, next year there'll be a promo for Millennial. We've got it done.
I mean, I was thinking about different, and then another idea came to me actually about advertising, where it would be like an advert for a Rolex watch or something that just happened to mention Millennial. Like, the perfect timepiece to make sure you never miss an episode of Millennial. You know, that kind of ridiculous things like that. They would just be funny. And I thought I had that idea as well. Maybe I'll do it next year. I don't know. I felt like it would just be really enjoyable.
Yeah, no. And I think that's fine. You know, it's what we do. We advertise. We do it. You know, when I put a link on Twitter for a stream, it's advertising. And, you know, we are part of that culture. And, you know, that's okay. But when you start, if we look at the Gillette advert, for example, there's a lot more going on. There's a lot more implications. The possible negative consequences of something like that on a huge cultural level. It's slightly different from a slight sort of, you know, your video is pastiche, essentially. It's kind of postmodern in that respect. It's a parody.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of them are not. You know, Gillette was not a parody.
No.
I know it's old news, but that was just, you know, a real milestone in woke culture. That was mind-blowing. And that sort of thread of race issues, the amount of black people that were protecting women from white men was just insane. What's going on?
Well, it's completely unreal. But again, this is an example, something I've talked about a lot this year in speeches that I've given is, and I did want to make videos, but, you know, whatever, let's not get into that. A point I've made is how much we're expected to live with lies and to believe them or go along with them, accept them, and even repeat them ourselves. And one of them is this ridiculous notion that, you know, white men are constantly attacking women and the women are constantly being saved by black men. I mean, it's just so... let's not get into the, you know, the race stuff, but it's... That is just fucking bullshit. It's absolutely... fantastically unrealistic and bizarre.
That is your quote for your advert. Let's not get into the race stuff, but that is fucking bullshit. well, listen, interestingly enough, where I think mass marketing is going, because the technology is evolving, and when you look at something like the Gillette advert or any like big advert at the moment, this is in relation to what you just said about lies and how we take them on and sometimes then repeat them, and certainly about how marketing and advertising kind of sculpts the sort of you know, modern world. It's like that modern art in a way, in terms of how we understand our world. Because marketing has invaded public space so much, it depicts our world like cinema does. And the problem with that is, at the moment, we've got something like Gillette. So a few million quid goes into it and, you know, a few hundred million people see it. But the way I think it's going, it's going to become more and more personalized, but with video. I mean, as I just explained to you, a marketing email to your inbox is kind of personalized. What have you bought? How many emails have you opened in the last 30 days? What's your average spend? So it's tailored to you, not just the subject line, but when you open it, what are we going to show him? What tool is it going to be? What product, et cetera, et cetera. That's becoming more personalized. But because the technology exists now, not yet, but if without a doubt, we're getting there. There will be video adverts that are personalized.
You know,
so you'll get an advert that isn't. Sorry?
Look at these deep fakes where they make Jim Carrey do what Jack Nicholson did 29 years ago. That's fucking incredible. Another one would be, I read about the technology some German company are inventing, so that dubbing, when a film is dubbed in German, the lips will actually match up with the German dubbing. That's fucking amazing. Cool.
So you'll be at home on your computer and you'll open a new web page and there'll be an advert from, let's just say, Gillette, for argument's sake. But with the amount of data through Twitter, through Facebook, through YouTube, through absolutely everything, your Gillette advert will be different to mine. Your one will be based on things you've bought, money you spent.
What guy standing outside the shop, and it'll be a white guy who intervenes.
Yeah, just tailored to you. Based on your behaviours.
I'd love to see Gillette kowtowing to me like that. That would be fucking...
No, I know. But the mad thing is, as much as you think you'd be aware of it, I think this stuff will be actually very subtle. But in terms of the rampant individualism of the last 30 years, can you understand how that is going to absolutely atomize people? Because we're going to have a different reality depicted. We're going to have something based on our behaviours, our things we've done in the past. So you won't get 500 million people seeing the same Gillette advert. You'll get 500 million people seeing a different advert.
That's incredible.
And when you want... Sorry?
It's just incredible. It's an amazing notion. I'm sure that you're probably right. I mean, one day they'll have Avril Lavigne saying to me something about, so you like Blake's, I like Blake 7 too, Colin.
And, yeah, no, absolutely.
You could watch it together if you just buy this incredible new TV. That
you need to be so careful when you're improvising. You just said so much about yourself. Oh, I'll have Avril Lavigne saying I like Blake 7 too. Did you get that, people? But no, absolutely. It will be the woman that you've looked at her pictures the most. It will be. It will. The background music will be the music you've played most on YouTube. It will. It will be perfectly tailored to make you happy, then instill a problem, then solve that problem. And in terms of separating us, if you think marketing separates us now, wait till that happens. We will be living in distinctly different, but artificial. And that's key, because there's nothing wrong with living in distinct different realities. We do. But when they're distinctly different and artificial and largely almost exclusively determined by a need to sell, it's terrifying. You know, look at Blade Runner. Blade Runner's got it. When he's flying about, those huge Asian women in the sky, they sort of call him by name and they're making suggestions for his dinner. And these are huge holograms in the street.
And this it's so funny. I know what you're saying is real and serious, but I just keep thinking about some huge women talking to me about Coca-Cola or something.
No, well, the funny thing is. The funny thing is, there will be in the early days, it's going to be very funny because there'll be people like us who have got very, very particular interests, and how they try and individualize our adverts are going to, it's going to be very interesting. But listen, if you look at it in terms of the online experience, I gave the example: you click on a website, there's a video advert for all of us based on our previous behaviors. But if you move that into the street, where you're going to have billboard adverts, which are going to be holograms, you're going to have things like that Blade Runner one where they're huge, but where the same two people walking down the same street are going to have different realities because of marketing. And you might be walking down the street with a lover, it might be a romantic day out, but in truth you're both inhabiting a different space.
Yeah, it is one of these things that will end up separating everyone from everyone.
That's my point. Which we are separate, but because it's artificial, because it's based in sales, that's what makes it problematic, to say the least. But you know, if you want Avril Lavigne whispering in your ear, I like Blake 7 too. It's a lovely image. Woz is a skater boy.
It's so ridiculous. But I think I would probably buy the product. I've got to admit.
Well, there you go.
All right.
There you go.
Someone said she would be saying, I love a man in a dressing gown. Buy this product. Yeah, and I'm such a fool, I would just do it. All right.
Yeah, well.
Let's go into Super Chats. If you've got any Super Chats or questions for Mr. Dangerfield, please post them now. But in the meantime, here's one. Would you ever move back to the UK?
Well, I'll never say never, because that would be ridiculous. I miss it. I miss it this time of year. Of course I miss it. It's far from Christmas here, I can assure you. There's a lot I miss. The longer I'm out here, the more I miss. I miss those. I'll tell you what I really miss, those crisp, cold mornings when the sun's out. I mean, they're few and far between in England, but they are gorgeous. I miss wrapping up. I miss putting a hat on, well, and a scarf and gloves and a big coat. I like all that. But my money goes further out here. You know, I'm not young. I'm nearly 50, and I put in a lot of time in England, and I tried. Out here, I can buy a house next year. I'm looking at buying a property and some land, and that's not an option for me in England unless it's somewhere absolutely horrific. So I don't know.
When was the last time you were in Britain?
I haven't been back for 2 years. I'll tell you what, though, if someone like a Salvini or an Orban got in power, if there were radical cultural, political, social changes in place and something actually exciting started happen and actual changes, I wouldn't want to miss it. I'd leave in the morning. But yeah, yeah, I can't see it happening just yet. Although having said that, I do kind of see, I think this recent Johnson thing and the size of it is kind of making the required social conditions for such a person to come along and capitalise on a shift in the Overton window.
Well, I hope so too, of course. We'll have to see. It does seem to be a certain turning point for Britain. And, this election, I mean, I talked about it quite extensively with Sargon in the first millennial this year, and Zurius. It does seem to be a turning point. I've no idea what will end up, how it will play out. But, yeah.
Well, as Hugh said to me, he said, and it was a really good point, because I'm kind of naive around a lot of this stuff, but it doesn't actually take a lot to make change. And it doesn't actually require a huge amount of people to make change. I mean, if you look at the trans lobby, how many are there? And they're having incredible effects at the level of media, academia and law, largely unchallenged. And, I don't think it would take too much. I think we're ripe for that kind of change. And listening to you talk to Jared and listening to you talk to Greg and just the recent changes in sort of what you could, loosely call this community, it's growing and it's growing. And I think it's having an effect. And if it's having an effect now, what could it be doing in 2, 3, 4 years?
Oh, absolutely.
And so, I mean, Italy is turned on a tuppence. Salvini's out of the way, but I think he'll be back very quickly. And I think these things can happen. I wouldn't be surprised. 5 years ago, no. But now, I was so optimistic and so energized listening to Greg and listening to Jared, those conversations you had with the pair of them. I just, it's not negative. We are in a very strong position at the moment. We've done well. People have done well.
I agree. I think that there's a lot of room for optimism. I mean, even if we are, as I said, even if we are going to lose YouTube, I think we're growing all the time, and that has to mean something. This is why, honestly, I didn't really understand JF's pessimism last night. I mean, I think he was maybe winding me up, and I was sort of falling for it, perhaps. I don't know. But it seemed genuine to me. I mean, the nihilism seemed fucking genuine to me, and the depression, the pessimism. So, but I didn't understand it because to me, we are objectively growing as a movement.
Yeah, for sure. And all this censorship is not for no reason. It's because they've observed an actual threat. And, and we're well adapt. We get chucked off YouTube, well adapt. Now, I get absolutely sick of the amount of black pills being chucked around and people in chats on my streams and other people's streams. It's all fucked, blah, blah, blah. You're doing the enemy's work among our ranks. Hope can carry a good idea further than a good idea can carry itself. Optimism is fuel. And if you want to spread misery and pessimism, why would you do the enemy's work among us? If you feel like that, fine. Keep it to yourself. Fuck off, because people are making an effort. People are making a consistent and relentless effort for change. And you're not helping. If you don't think it's going anywhere, then you're not going to contribute to changing that. Jog on.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that Alinsky said, and I keep saying this because it's very useful, is that activism should be fun. Now, I don't necessarily see what we do as activism. I think it's cultural. You could say it's cultural activism. I think it's cultural activity. Let's put it that way. And it should be fun. And I think it should be because, and I'm saying this, I'm a very depressive, melancholic guy. I'm aware of that, so it's kind of ironic for me to be saying this. But I think it's true that part of the reason for my own malaise over the last year is that I think I've responded to a downturn in the movement as a whole. That there has been a lot of despondency, and it's affected me. But I'm not blaming everyone else, by the way, for my own problem. I'm just saying I think I did absorb a lot of that defeatism or lack of direction. And I think it's important that we keep our spirits up and keep each other's spirits up, because it is daunting, as someone said in the chat, and it is intimidating. And I think it's very important to try to maintain momentum and morale. Morale is very important. The left know this, right? Yeah. That's why the left are not fucking... They're constantly fighting, constantly reassuring each other about the value of the cause that they're fighting, and constantly looking for new ways in which to enjoy what they're doing. You know, sometimes I think now they're starting to fail actually in that. This is a thing that we're now noticing, that the left have lost the gaiety that they used to have, and I mean that word seriously. They're now starting to feel despair because after Brexit. Yeah. After Trump and after this new general election, it's defeat after defeat for them. And same with the nationalist elections in throughout the continent. To us, these are small gains. To the left, they're fucking devastating. They're really disturbing. And I think that we should really bear that in mind. Now, to pick up on what someone said, that there is so much to do. It's daunting how much there is to do. Yes, but look at how much we've already done. And, you know, this is something I used to hear, used to see lefties saying to each other, yes, we've done a lot, but there's so much left to do. Well, conversely, yeah, there's a lot left to do, but look how much we've done already. Compare this now with the situation when I started my channel at the start of 2014. It's a different situation entirely. There's now a massive social thing attached to being a creator in this movement, both on YouTube and on the internet, on Telegram, and in real life. None of that existed in when I started. Yeah. So really, yeah. We've made massive strides. So yeah, there's a lot of room to a lot of reason to feel good about it and to feel optimistic.
For sure, and also, you know, the stakes are pretty high. You know, we need to take a bit of intimidation on the chin, and you know what you were saying. I mean, like the nationalist growth over the continent is incredible, absolutely incredible, and the left are absolutely screwing. No, man, and you know, you said we have a couple of knocks. Look at the journey Jared has been on for decades. And look where he is now. And when we talk about the occasional loss or a bit of negativity, you look at him and what he's been through. He is surfing a wave of optimism because he knows what it's like to have nothing happening. Like nothing, like him, almost a solo warrior, you know, going around places with a microphone, trying to convince people that it's even a problem, let alone that we need solutions. No, we're flying at the moment. It's been a success after success, and we need to focus on those.
Yeah, I think that those are very relevant words, very sensible and true. I mean, we need to focus on the success and on the positives. So yeah, thank you for saying those things, Dangerfield. Okay, here. Well, it's true. That's the thing, right? I mean it. Like, thank you for saying that, because it's relevant and it's helpful. And I think it's right to say these things.
You know, you'll hear people talk about the culture war this, the culture war that. Well, the key word there is war. We are warriors. We've got to fight this. And, you know, when you're fighting, I say this all the time, when you're fighting on the front line, remember why you're fighting. Remember what's going on behind you. Remember why you're here. Remember why you come to these streams. Remember why you watch what you do. You say what you say, because there is something huge. Our future is at stake. So fight, and fight as best you can. And, you know, these people in the chats, it's all over. We're doomed. You might as well, you're a double agent. You're working for the enemy. And I see that stuff spread. You know, and young people don't want to hear that. If you're 16, 17, and you're starting to wake up and you come to a stream to hear this stuff, and you're seeing 40-year-old people saying, we're all fucked, we're doomed, you know, brackets here and all this, it's like, you fuck off. Because these people need encouragement. They need to know that if they come along, if they sacrifice their reputation, if they make getting jobs difficult, like Unwashed, he's been already excluded from his loads of professions and groups he was part of. These people need encouraging, and positivity, optimism and hope will encourage people. And the opposite will make them think, you know what, fuck this, I'm going to go back to how I was before. The Warriors. Yeah.
That is true. And I think that it's often, I mean, it can seem silly to say that about, like, for me, for example, sitting here in this blanket, or you with that hat on. But I think it is true that we are fighting. I mean, this is a culture war. And I've said this to people. We are fighting a war. And therefore, it's very important that we are straightforward with each other, that we're helpful to each other, that we're there for each other, and that we don't poison each other. And it's all very well. Yeah. I mean, everyone has moments of doubt. And everyone has, I mean, spells, long spells of doubt. But don't use that to poison other people. That's
absolutely.
Because, you know, I mean, I've never been in a war, right? So I'm not going to act like Billy Big Bollocks, as a friend of mine would say. But clearly, a crucial part of being out of fighting a war successfully is solidarity, basically.
It's so, morale. You know, I read this thing. I can't remember the book now, but it was about the in the trenches in the First World War, and the commander said that the best fighting happens on post day, when people receive their letters, when they remember what they're fighting for, when people back home are communicating to them, when they remember the scope. You know, when they remember they're not just in a hole in the ground with a gun and with trench foot. It's actually about what's happening. And that on those days, they fought their best. It's morale.
Absolutely. Okay, here's our super chat. I appreciate Dangerfield's authenticity and humor. Thanks for having him on, Woz. To Dangerfield, where would you suggest a potential expat from the US move to?
It depends what you want. I mean, you know, it depends what you want. You need to isolate, write a list. What do you want out of, why are you moving? What changes do you want to make? And then find a place that kind of suits those requirements. But remember, leaving your country, it's a lot. It's a lot to do. It's a big sacrifice in many ways. But, you know, you need to identify what you want out of your move. I don't actually like encouraging people to move.
Yeah.
I get told off for it.
I understand. Okay, well, I think that's all the questions. There don't seem to be any others, which is a bit surprising. But, okay, shall we? It has been 80 minutes, so that seems like a fairly substantial stream. And I've certainly enjoyed it. I think a lot of people have. So, all right, let's... someone says, praise DF, which is nice. All right. So, okay, well, I'll be back tomorrow with, let me just see what's on tomorrow. Okay, The Absolute State of Britain, Mark Collett, All Well and Good, and then On the Offensive. So that should be another very different set of streams. And all right, so in the meantime, this is the fifth night over. So thank you, Dangerfield, for taking part in Millennial 2019.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, and thanks everyone for staying with me and commenting. It's been a good night, and I'll see you tomorrow. Bye for now.